good news and issues from a superior point of view.
The water's fine, but memories of swimming class may not be.
So today we start swimming. Oh, and who didn't bring their birthday suit?
The naked truth of when Twin Ports boys were required to swim nude in public schools. Plus,
my dad worked hard.
He was just an ordinary man, but worthy of a musical tribute. Rachel Kilgore's homage to her dad. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The fall school semester is in full swing, and that means swimming classes for most high school students, both as part of physical education and to teach kids personal life-saving skills. But for a good number of men my generation, in their 60s and above, memories of swimming at school are more than a little traumatic. That's because at my school in Chicago, and in Duluth and Superior, and across the country, boys had to swim nude. And if this is the first time you're hearing that, you're probably saying, "What?" But yes, it was true, and there was no way out of it. I first commented on it for National Public Radio and the Duluth News Tribune back in 2006, reporting that others my age remembered it, proving I wasn't crazy. Two of those are Mike Rosenzweig and Steve Davis, both of Duluth, who I caught up again with recently to hear their stories. Here's Mike.
Well, when I was a kid growing up, you were in elementary school till sixth grade. And then in seventh grade, you moved up and you were in this thing called junior high. So you're in there and you're scared about absolutely everything that goes on. And the next thing you know, we're going to be in swimming class. And our instructor at that time, our teacher said, "Okay, so today we start swimming." Oh, and who didn't bring their birthday suit? Well, we're a bunch of seventh graders. And so what do? We all raise our hands. "Oh, I didn't bring one. Did you bring one?" "No, I didn't bring one." So he kind of chuckles and says, "Okay, everybody take your clothes off, put it in your lockers, and we're going to go jump in the pool." And it's like, "But we don't have any swim trunks." "That's correct. You will all be exactly the same." Now, that all being said, the teacher, of course, had swim trunks on. And so I just want to make sure we clarify that.
Yes, important detail to know.
So anyway, so we all strip down and we go into the pool, and it's warm, it's hot. You know, you've got the chlorine and everything else. And the first thing we're worried about is that girls might come in. That was not the case, though. We had that well protected, I think. At least from what we could see. We got gathered around the pool and we're all kind of standing there, and hard not to kind of look at each other, I guess, a little bit. And there was one kid there who didn't look like the rest of us. And that was the kid in class that wasn't circumcised. We didn't know what the issue was. And actually, a couple of the guys thought, well, maybe when he slammed the door to his locker, he got caught by the locker. That's all we could think of. So we all go jump in the pool. And the one thing we learned very early on is no belly flops into the pool. When you don't have trunks on, boy, you know you've belly flopped into the pool. And that went on. You know, did we tell our parents? No, I don't think we ever did, because we just thought this was normal after a while. And after a while, it just became like, I guess this is what we do.
And that was Mike Rosenzweig of Duluth with his memories of the swimming program at Ordine Junior High in the 1960s. A little bit across town, Steve Davis was having a similar experience at Washington Junior High. Here's Steve.
I was at Washington from 64 to 67, and we had naked swimming classes. It was, you know, it was kind of an embarrassing situation for that age group. Also, you had people snapping people with towels, and it was easier to snap somebody's butt naked than it was not naked. So that was interesting. And that did happen, not necessarily me, but it did happen. I always had somebody in the group. There was one scenario where the principal, I think it was, and maybe part of the school board was doing a tour and happened to walk through the pool area, and it turned out to be during a swim class. And I'm sure it was more embarrassing for them than for us. You know, we had other programs where we went swimming at the Y sometimes, but in the school system, you were naked.
And that was Steve Davis of Duluth. Well, the story I did back in the aughts has followed me ever since, and other journalists have done it as well. One is reporter Monica Ng of Axios, who reported on it for Chicago's public radio station, WBEZ, in 2017. She's also an alum of my high school, Lane Tech in Chicago. And she joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Monica.
Thanks, Robin. Great to be here.
So you researched this thoroughly, more than I did, and you can attest one more time, I'm not crazy, right? And neither are the other men my age who remember this.
That is right. In fact, my father, after I did the story, said, yep, at Senn High School, we did the same thing.
Right. And I should emphasize again that this was only for boys swimming. Girls were allowed to wear suits, although there were complaints they were not exactly the most fashionable, but they did do the job of covering up. So one of the biggest questions both you and I got when we did these stories was what happened to the policy and when did it stop? So I started by calling the Chicago public schools and promptly got no answer to the question. What did you find?
This was the third rail. They would not touch this. I mean, CPS, Chicago Public Schools, I'm an alum. I cover Chicago. I cover CPS all the time. This was like, you know, worse than any other scandal where, you know, the head of CPS gets fired. And so that's what made me think, boy, there's a story here.
Well, as I said, I didn't get an answer from them either, but I did get a response from the Duluth School Department and even documentation, which reads, be it hereby resolved that the Duluth School District include in its 1973-74 budget an amount that secures a sufficient number of tank suits for the boys' swim program and that the practice of requiring boys to swim nude be discontinued immediately. And this was sponsored by school committee member Ruth Myers, for whom Duluth's Myers-Wilkins Middle School is now named, who added, having to swim in the nude when one does not have a choice is very objectionable. So that would have been right after when I took swimming in 1971 and 72 in Chicago. When did it end there?
Well, it just kind of faded away. It seemed to have faded by the early 80s. I'm not sure why it stuck around for 20 years after, you know, any health association was even recommending it, but it finally faded out and no one will tell me why.
I should point out, by the way, that Superior has a slightly different history, for which we'll give a nod to Superior High grad Michelle Bear Baden, who says that there was no pool at the old high school, which was replaced in 1965. Nude swimming for boys was required when the new school opened, but lasted just a few years, ending around the time that Duluth abandoned it. So the bigger question, though, is why it started in the first place. My classmates had all kinds of theories, mostly about hygiene and that somehow it was good for boys, but not girls. I'm still trying to figure out that. But you actually found documentation dating back to the 1920s.
Yep. The American Public Health Association, which was a fairly influential association, said in its guidelines that at pools used exclusively by men, nude bathing should be required. At indoor pools used exclusively by women, bathing suits should be of the simplest type. Suits, when used, should be of wool or cotton or simple design or of undyed material or tested for fastness of color. And that's what launched a million nude swimming classes.
And I should note that we did invite a representative from the American Public Health Association to come and talk about that history. They declined, but did say they'd be happy to discuss other subjects. The wool is interesting because I understand that there was an issue of, first of all, there were wool suits, mostly in the late 19th century, not so much in the 20th, but in any case, there was wool suits and they were clogging filtration systems.
Right. Yeah. Some of the fibers could clog them. And that's what you made swimsuits out of at the time. I mean, there was no nylon. Nylon had not been invented. And so, of course, they say wool or cotton. I'm not sure, like, what else he would have used at the time.
So The American Public Health Association, when they came up with this, this wasn't just a whim. They were basing it on certain things, that clogging was part of it, I believe. But I spoke with historian Professor Jeff Wiltsey of the University of Montana, who is a expert on the history of swimming pools. And he's documented it and writes that public pools were initially created as public baths for working class people in the late 19th century. Here's my conversation with him. We're speaking with Jeff Wiltsey, professor of history at the University of Montana. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Jeff.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
So men and boys have been skinny dipping in rivers and lakes since time immemorial. What happened when the first swimming pools were created in the United States in the late 1800s? And did they just jump into pools au naturel?
Yes. So the first thing to understand is that the earliest pools in the United States, the earliest public pools, were actually baths. They were public baths. They did not have showers attached to them because the pool itself was the instrument of cleaning. And these pool baths were intended to provide a place for people who lived in the slum neighborhoods of cities, in which the housing, the tenements, didn't have bathing facilities, a place to be able to clean themselves as a way of trying to combat the spread of epidemic diseases. And not surprisingly, as a bath, that patrons, male patrons in particular, would plunge into them naked. And what I find particularly interesting is that that was, as you suggested, an extension of the natural water swimming culture that had existed in and around American cities, in which plebeian working class boys and young men would plunge into the lakes and rivers naked. And in those public settings, they were very much considered to be a nuisance, whereas the requirement was for them to be able to enter the pool baths that they would shed their clothes and plunge in naked, both because they didn't want the dirt from their clothes to add to the dirtiness of the water, but also because they wanted their bodies to be as clean as possible.
And you've written about the racial segregation of swimming pools, which is a different subject, and perhaps we should delve into that later. But so I take it they had gender separation.
Yeah. So what I found is, not surprisingly, at these early pool baths, that there was strict separation along sex lines. And so males and females either used separate pool baths, or they used the same pool bath, but at different times. But at least somewhat surprising to me is that these early pool baths, at least in the northern United States, were not racially segregated.
Mm-hmm. And so what about the women? In high school, of course, our whole story is about the boys were required to swim nude, but the girls got these very dour-looking bathing suits they weren't too happy about. But, you know, we were quite envious that they had anything. So since the baths were meant to be baths, did the women swim nude?
So the limited evidence that I came across with regards to this, and whereas there was lots of evidence indicating that boys and young men plunged into these early pool baths naked. What limited evidence I was able to find that addressed this for girls and young women is that they did not enter the pools naked, that they in fact had clothes on. And so there was a clear kind of sex distinction, or what we might call today a gender double standard, when it came to plunging into these early pools.
Which lasted for about 100 years almost. So these early pools didn't have chlorine or filtering systems, I understand. And when filters were introduced, swimwear was largely made of wool and clogged them up. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. The attempts to purify the water in pools begins around the turn of the 20th century. And it is a response to popular acceptance of the germ theory of disease transmission. And so when pools were intended to serve as public baths, that was before the germ theory of disease transmission was well understood and popularly accepted. And so the idea was that dirt and kind of the aromas that emanate from dirt and dirtiness are what causes diseases to be transferred from one person to another, sort of the miasma theory of disease transmission. It turned out that these pools in which the waters were not filtered or treated with a chemical treatment to purify them actually served as a very, very good medium for germs to transfer from one person to another. And so when this gets understood by the end of the 1890s, that's when you begin to see cities install filtering systems in their pools. And it's also when cities install showers at their pools. And so the pools are no longer now serving as public baths because the bathers are now, the swimmers are now cleansing themselves in showers before they enter the pool. And so that's the point at which pools get redefined as fitness institutions, and then very quickly in the early 20th century as almost playground type spaces for kids.
Right. And regardless, though, the male tradition of nudity continues for all these various reasons we've heard. We've been speaking with Jeff Wiltsey, professor of history at the University of Montana, who's focused on the history of swimming pools. Thank you for joining us, Professor Wiltsey.
I very much appreciated talking with you.
And we're back with reporter Monica Ng. So what did you find of the early history?
I heard that the reason why we had so many swimming pools starting in the 1920s at high schools is because of the epidemic of drowning. Hmm. And they believed that we needed to start teaching young people right now and making sure they know how to swim to stop so many people from dying. And that's another reason why so many YMCAs came up. But it was, public bathhouses were also a big thing because people didn't have their own bathroom in many of the houses in the early part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Monica Ng. She's a reporter for Axios, and she previously was at Chicago Public Radio Station WBEZ-FM, where she did a report on nude swimming required for boys in public high schools in Chicago and around the country, including in the Twin Ports. We are looking at the origins of that. Since you did that story, you, as I said, the story just doesn't go away. It keeps following me. There's podcasts keep calling me up and wanting to talk about it, one will give a nod to them. American Hysteria earlier this year. You can look that up. And another one called The Dollop. They didn't call me. They just quoted me. And they actually had a lot of the information we're talking about, but I will warn more sensitive listeners that they use very explicit language, and hence they loved this subject matter. So since you did the piece for WBEZ, you've heard more about the whys and wherefores.
Yeah, I talked to, because CPS wouldn't talk to me, I did find an old retired coach who talked to me. And, his excuse was, the reason why, and it was silly, the reason why boys got to swim naked and girls didn't is because the girls have more to cover, is what he said. Okay, that seems weird. But while I was doing a lot of sort of like radio call-in shows at BZ over this, one gentleman who was not able to get on the air, but who wanted to talk to me afterwards, he said he was a gym teacher at the time, a PE teacher at that time. And he said, if you'll notice, a lot of PE teachers in that period were veterans. Mm-hmm. And he said, in their mind, every boy in every generation is going to probably have to go serve in the Army. And that this was a way to kind of get them used to that lack of privacy and get them ready to serve their country. And I thought, okay, I guess that's the most generous way to look at it, that they wanted to prepare them. They didn't want them to be shocked when they went into the Army that there was this total lack of privacy. What do you think about that?
What do I think about that? Well, it was indeed a rite of passage, and frankly, it did feel very military. I have a little aside here, which is that there was a rumor that if you took ROTC at our high school in Chicago, you didn't have to take swimming.
Right. That's the irony, right?
Actually, that wasn't true. If you took ROTC, you did not have to take gym. And swimming was part of gym, but swimming was also part of ROTC. And there was a rude awakening for many a young man when he found out that, guess what? Yes, you have to go to ROTC today And you got swimming class tomorrow. So, and there were actually a few times I think they had to wear their uniforms and then get out of those uniforms and get into the pool. One more commentary on the rite of passage kind of thing. I mean, you know, you had no choice. As I just said with the RLTC, you couldn't get out of it. So the best you could do was endure it. You really didn't look at your fellow classmates that much. By the way, we did wear something. We all wear bathing caps, which I see looking
good.
Back.
At least they let you do that.
Isn't that great? And for the beginner swimmers like me, who really never did learn to float very well, we got an inner tube. So I don't know if I want to paint that picture for you or not, but that's what we were doing. We were wearing a bathing cap, holding an inner tube, sometimes around our midsection, which is not a bad idea, and getting in that pool. All right, listeners, if you would like to continue this conversation, send your emails to Monica, not me, okay? Can I get away from this? We've been speaking with Monica Ng. She's a reporter for Axios in Chicago and formerly with WBEZ Public Radio, where she did a report about nude swimming by boys as required in the Chicago public schools and many school districts across the country, including in the Twin Ports. Thank you for joining us, Monica.
Thank you, Robin.
Coming up, Rachel Kilgore pays tribute to her ordinary father.
There's a sharp-looking man with a farmer's tan in my baby book. Shoulders back, he leaned into a broken world. He had a head of curls like his baby girl.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Today, Friday, September 22nd, is, well, it's the fall, so it's not Father's Day. But is there a time when, whatever our relationship, we don't think about our dads? For Rachel Kilgore, we could call today Father's Day because it's the drop of her new album, My Father Loved Me, and she'll be performing selections of it tonight at Zeitgeist in Duluth. As local music lovers know, Rachel is one of the Twin Ports breakout singer-songwriters who's taken her show on the road to venues across the country, picking up more than a few national music awards along the way. And she's gracious enough to stop by and visit us from time to time, and this is one of those times. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Rachel Kilgore.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the idea of doing an album for your father began when you were just completing another album, Game Changer, in, I think that was 2019. So was this 4 years in the making?
No, it was a few years. I wrote the very first song for my father when he was still alive and living with, he had dementia at the end of his life. So I wrote a song for him then that I never played for him, but I had finished that and went into the studio for Game Changer. After he passed, and I decided to hold off on recording that song because I felt I hadn't written anything yet, but I just knew I was going to. and I just kind of decided in that moment that no, I think there's a lot of songs in me about my dad, and I'd rather keep them together.
Mm-hmm. So tell us the inspiration. Tell us about your dad.
Well, my dad was he was a self-employed contractor. He was a very hard worker and really prided himself on being trustworthy and generous with his time. He always gave a fair price and worked extra long hours to get things done on time for people. And that meant when I was growing up, he wasn't home a lot. In my early years, I was with my mom a lot, who was a stay-at-home mom. But dad did always come to our school events, to my softball games, and he was always there for dinner and bedtime. But I was the baby of the family, so I actually didn't get to know him as well as I wanted to. By the time I reached adulthood, he was already starting to show signs of dementia. And so I think with this record, I'm kind of trying to figure out for myself who my dad was and the more complicated parts of his relationship with his own family and his identity and what that all means about me.
And part of that identity was being Canadian. So when you talk about growing up, tell us where that was? Well, he was from Canada, but he wandered into Duluth or something like that?
Yeah.
People always wander over here. Yes.
Duluth is my home. I was born and raised in Duluth, but I am a dual citizen because my father is from Southern Ontario.
And when you say it's Southern Ontario, that narrows it down to about 2,000 miles. So
very Southern Ontario. Yeah, farm country. Like, it's near London, Ontario.
Oh, okay, but, right. I mean, small town Thunder Bay is technically Southern Ontario, too, even though it's...
Yeah, that's true. That's right. True.
To us, it feels like it's three miles from the North Pole.
Yeah.
Well, rather than talk about it, let's hear one of the selections. Can you suggest one and set it up?
Sure. I often like to start with the first one that I wrote, My Dad Worked Hard. It just kind of describes the physical labor my dad did every day at work. A lot of lifting and hammering and climbing and being in the sun all day. And it kind of examines how we value labor in our country and how we compensate different kinds of work.
All right. And here is Dad Worked Hard by Rachel Kilgore.
My dad worked hard from the time he was young to win the respect of his father and the love of his mom, and nobody had high hopes for the scrappy farm kid. But nobody loved a challenge like my old man. With his hands and his sweat, with a hammer and a cigarette, long hours in the hot sun, he built a foundation, late for dinner every night, a sunburn and an appetite. In the end, he made out all right, with three kids and a dad worked hard. Did yours work harder? That what his thriving investments prove? I'm not saying that he didn't earn the right to take it easy. I'm just saying that I'm pretty sure my dad did. Got the job done right. No, he couldn't call him lazy, and he wouldn't overcharge you, not like the big names did. He built a house from the ground up, run the numbers in his head. He'd make enough to feed the family and make it home to tuck me into bed. And he never gave up until his body gave in and his mind grew thin. And you never can tell how time will treat you. She's a great deceiver. But now he's home every night. He's home every day too. He needs help getting out of his chair and can't remember how to tie his shoes. I've been looking for the safety net, the one that's supposed to catch him. When we can't afford the care he needs, and he worked his whole damn life. My dad was yours work harder. Is that what a comfortable retirement proves? Now I'm not saying that he didn't earn the right to take it easy. I'm just saying that I'm pretty sure my dad did too. Thank you.
And that was Dad Worked Hard by our guest, Rachel Kilgore. She'll be appearing tonight, September 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at Zeitgeist in Duluth as the album drop celebration for her album, My Father Loved Me. And we've been calling him Dad in this conversation. His name was?
Oh, yeah, his name was Bob Kilgore.
So tell us more about his influence on your work. Was he musical? And by the way, I had mentioned this to you before. You kind of started out as a violinist, and he didn't yell at you to stick with it. What are you doing with that guitar?
Yeah, actually, he did.
Okay, I knew there was somebody other than me that remembered this.
He didn't yell at me for it, no, but he did. He would regularly come to my concerts, like my singing concerts later into his life, and after the show would say, oh, but you should hear her play the violin.
Ooh, all right. This guy is validating my memory. I'm not crazy. You really did play it, yes.
I did, yeah, I did. He really loved that. How did he influence my work? I mean, both of my parents obviously heavily influenced who I am as a person. In this record, I'm definitely looking a lot at, you know, my dad was part of a certain generation and had really a lot of pressure as a man to kind of find his sense of identity through how he performed masculinity. And I noticed that that became a really big challenge for him when dementia showed up. Obviously, that was nobody wants that, but it was especially challenging for him to lose both his physical strength, his cognitive abilities, his ability to like provide financially for his family, all of these pieces, all of these very common ideas that men have held to. And I noticed that as dementia took over, that it was humiliating for him. And so through this, many of the songs in this record, I think I'm kind of looking at these places that my dad kind of secretly held some shame about things. And then, you know, by telling the truth about them through the song and then loving him anyway, I feel like I'm somehow taking the power out of those things.
You know, are all these songs positive? Are any of them critical? I imagine you're painting a picture of him. So I'm wondering if in some of that you're using some darker colors as well as the bright ones.
Yeah, I would say probably every song on the record is very truthful. Sometimes uncomfortably truthful. I think the point of even making the record is that, you know, my dad was a really ordinary guy. He lived his life. He showed up, he did his work. He tried to be someone that you could trust. And in the end, it's not like, you know, he was very extraordinary to me because he was my father, but to make an entire album about this guy who lived just a very average life, I think the point of that is to remind us all that we are worth celebrating and that we might screw up. We might let the people around us down. We might have insecurities, and yet we are worth celebrating. So, yes, there's a song on the record that talks about our family road trips to Ontario. And in that one time during our trip when I was a teenager, we had a big car accident. And that was due to the fact that my dad fell asleep at the wheel. And people fall asleep at the wheel, but a lot of us predicted it, and he refused to give up his seat driving. So when it happened, it was really hard for the family. Everyone survived. We were fine, but we all kind of collectively decided that we were never going to talk about it again. Dad couldn't handle facing it. He didn't really know how to apologize or how to be forgiven. I don't think he knew to forgive himself. But that's an example of a song where I love my dad to death. And also, of course, he screwed up sometimes, and it would have been easy to have that conversation, even though it's an incredibly difficult conversation to have. So there's a lot of conversations I'm having with him through the songs about things we never talked about.
Well, let's hear it. I don't think you could set it up better if you tried. Here's Ontario by Rachel Kilgore.
Sister's got a bucket. It'll be a long drive to your father's side of the border. clock stop and say Ignis before we cross the Mackinac and on through to the green tobacco fields of southern Ontario. Do you still love my father, Ontario? Could you love a trader's daughter? Bowling five pin at the alley on the corner. Grab a donut from Tim Hortons. Get my accent back in order. Grandma's elderberry pie. Grandpa's yard sale finds and by leaving time. I'm Canadian again. But Dad, do you ever get homesick? And how come they never visit? And when you're working so hard, are you just trying to forget? Are you just trying to forget? Ontario, do you still love my father? Ontario, could you love a trader's daughter? Driving through the night when I was older, it was my turn at the wheel, but Dad said move on over. Getting back, so I sat and thought about how easily he falls asleep when he's reading, watching TV. Is it safe to shut my
Ontario by our guest Rachel Kilgore. She'll be appearing tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Zeitgeist in Duluth as the album drop celebration for My Father Loved Me. Where can we find out more about your music?
You can find it on my website. It's always a good spot. I'm going to be playing some dates actually in Ontario coming up in October. But if people want to order things or find more or contact me, they can do it at my website, rachelkilgore.com. RachelKilgore.com.
All right. And one more song to take us out?
Yeah. This is My Father Loved Me, the title track from the record. And it's about my dad. Surprise.
All right. We've been speaking with Rachel Kilgore. Her new album dropping tonight is My Father Loved Me, which you'll be performing selections from at Zeitgeist in Duluth at 7:30 p.m. Thank you for joining us, Rachel.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
There's a sharp-looking man with a farmer's tan in my baby book. Shoulders back, he leaned into a broken world. He had a head of curls like his baby girl and a devilish grin. He was a tender-hearted trickster, and I'm a lot like and my father loved me when he could not love himself. He put his faith in me when he was certain he would fail. So when the world has been unkind and doubts weigh on my mind, I try and love myself the way my father loved me.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Hello, Shalon.
Hello, Robin.
So, Rick, there's a controversial hotel project planned for the mall area of Duluth, and it's drawn the wrath of opponents, but they got a setback last week.
Yes, they did. After meeting for more than an hour in closed session with staff and legal counsel, members of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board voted 10-1 on Wednesday not to intervene in an appeal of the Duluth City Council's decision to support plans to build a controversial hotel. A group of citizens had challenged the city's reversal of a previous decision by the Duluth Planning Commission to require the developer, Kinseth Hospitality Companies, to complete an environmental assessment worksheet before commencing work on the project. Opponents have cited the impact the development will have on wetlands and neighboring Miller Creek, which is a designated trout stream that's already considered an impaired waterway. About 250 people signed a petition calling for a greater review of the $18 million project. Kinseth, based in Coralville, Iowa, intends to build a 100-room, four-story hotel across from Kohl's at the corner of West Page Street and Sunbee Road. An attorney representing Kinseth estimated an environmental assessment worksheet would cost his client between $50,000 to $55,000 and would push back the project timeline by 8 to 10 months. In June, the city council agreed to grant a legal stay, suspending work on the site until the case could be considered by the Minnesota Court of Appeals. But the stay was predicated on the project's opponent's ability to post a $1.6 million bond to pay the developer for the cost of construction delays in the event that Kinseth prevailed in court. Concerned citizens had until July 10 to raise the money, but they were unable to do so, and the developer has since pushed ahead with clearing and preparing the site for construction.
All right. Well, earlier in the show, we just told you more than you ever thought you needed to know about one type of indoor swimming. The city of Duluth is looking at creating a task force to improve indoor sports activities overall.
Yes, on Wednesday, Mayor Emily Larson announced the formation of the Indoor Athletics Venues Task Force to draft a set of recommendations intended to help Duluth meet the community's needs for quality, accessible athletic venues. A 9-13 member task force will deliver its findings to Duluth City Council by September 30 of next year. The committee will be chaired by Todd Fedora, who is a lifetime Duluth resident and served on the city council from 2007 to 2011. Now, the task force won't just focus on opportunities for kids, but also weekend warriors and older adults looking for a safe place to walk in the winter. Earlier this year, the Minnesota legislature extended the city's 0.5% sales tax to fund a portion of the construction costs. About 2 weeks ago, Larson announced a 10-year, four-phase plan to invest in athletic facilities and fields across the city. Larson said that more indoor facilities and ice sheets mean youth sports tournaments can go bigger if those things are available in Duluth. Fedora noted that he has been chasing lacrosse sticks for 6 years, and most of the tournaments are in the Twin Cities. Larson said that this is actually about tourism. but it's also founded on the need for us to do more for our kids, our families, and one another. Applications for the task force will be accepted until 4:30 p.m. on October 6th, with members announced in mid-October.
All right. And moving across the bay, Douglas County is planning on improving the reentry process for ex-offenders.
Yes, a plan to use Douglas County opioid settlement dollars to fund a new reentry specialist job at the jail has cleared one step toward approval. The Douglas County Health and Human Services Board gave its go-ahead September 14. The specialist would connect people leaving incarceration with community resources and provide case management and long-term support for those who have opioid use disorder or at risk for opioid use. The jail has a program coordinator currently, which is able to provide information on where inmates can apply for basic needs, such as a Social Security card, an ID card, food share, badge of care, housing, and other things, but they can't go with them. The new position is aimed at reducing relapse, recidivism, crime, and opioid-related deaths. The primary focus would be to aid known opioid users in getting treatment and other resources in place. Health and Human Services Director Anna Carlson said that if inmates go back among the using culture and population after they're released, they often go back to using the same amount as they did prior to incarceration, and it's too much for their bodies. Drug-related deaths in Douglas County, like a lot of other places, have increased at an alarming number. The reentry specialist would be able to conduct a pre-release assessment to find out what each person's needs are and build a personalized plan to overcome those barriers. The multifaceted job includes creating a resource list, advocating for reentry clients, connecting with resource providers, partnering with the courts and with the Superior Police Department's crisis response specialist, tracking success, and even providing transportation to job interviews and treatment. If the position is approved, it can be funded with the county's opioid settlement dollars for 15 years. Cost projections for the program, which includes salary, training, and a vehicle, range from $88,000 to $127,000 per year.
All right. Well, Shalon, also on the Wisconsin side, there's an outpouring of support for the family of a Moose Lake, Minnesota man who was lost in a construction accident in Superior.
Yes, there is, Robin. 31-year-old Kenny Pounton was working on a roof last week when he fell off. Now, he leaves behind his fiance and two children, according to a GoFundMe page that has been set up by his sister. According to the Superior Fire Department, they got a phone call on Friday that a man fell off of a roof. Crews responded. The Mayo Clinic ambulance brought him to Ascension Health St. Mary's Medical Center in Duluth. Now, the family, again, has set up that GoFundMe page. And if you would like to learn more about it, you can head over to the website at www.gofundme.com. Help the family of Kenny.
And finally, back on the Minnesota side, people with disabilities now have a new opportunity to visit and get around state parks.
Yes, they do, Robin. Now, Split Rock Lighthouse State Park has joined with 12 other parks that now offer a new all-terrain track chair. These track chairs can be used for anyone who might have a injury or have other mobile issues. According to the Department of Natural Resources Parks and Recreational Area Program Consultant Jamie McBride, the track chair is a mobility device that allows people to get off the hardest surface of the park and into the park and onto the trails. It's something that has given people access to the park in a way that they haven't had before. Split Rock Lighthouse State Park has 10 miles of trails suited for the track chairs. The all-terrain chairs can be located at several state parks, including Lake Bemidji, Lake Carlson, and Maplewood. To find out more information, you can head over to the DNR website and search track chairs.
All right. We've been joined by Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Thank you, Shalon.
Thank you, Robin.
And Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org, DuluthNewsTribune.com, and WDIO.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more of the music of Rachel Kilgore. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
The changing of the seasons from summer into fall. 3 years ago, I flew back home after that call. The birch leaves fade yellow. Maple turns to red and ever. was just the other day that I remembered you were dead. It was just the other day, and the day before that too. Not one hour has passed that I don't think of losing you. Now who'll be my fortress if you're